The following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
Okay, hello everyone. I wanted to welcome all of you to our history series, which we call Jewish History in 24 Hours. Don't panic, it doesn't mean we're going to stay here for 24 hours straight, but rather, I've designed the course to be approximately, we hope, give or take a class, 32 classes of 45 minutes each, which is going to be a basic overview of all of Jewish history, 4,000 years. Now, the problem is usually when I mention the word history, most people sort of break out in a cold sweat. They remember back to junior high school or high school, and most people associate history with the memorization of names, dates, places, and events to promptly be spit out on an exam and then forgotten afterwards, which is probably why my favorite quote about education from Mark Twain is, "I never let my schooling interfere with my education." So before we actually begin talking about Jewish history, let's talk a little bit about why learn history in the first place. So first, let's clear our mind of any preconceptions we have about what history is or isn't, and let's talk a little bit about the positive uses of history. You know, a couple of things we could say about history. One is, first of all, certainly the testing ground of ideas. You know, we could talk in theory about ideas, but history clearly shows us which ideas are right or wrong. For instance, 100 years ago, a communist and a capitalist could debate which system would dominate the world, but 100 years of history has shown us communism has failed and capitalism works. There's a Jewish historian by the name of Lucy Davidovits, and she said it beautifully. She said, history is the magistrate vitae, the teacher of life. Okay, there's a tremendous amount of lessons that can be learned from history. And what's the biggest lesson? I would say my favorite quote about the correct use of history is from Spanish-American writer-philosopher George Santayana, who died in 1954. And he said what is probably the most famous quote about history, "Those who can't remember the past are destined to repeat it." So the basic reason to learn history in general is that people more or less are the same. Technology changes, the geopolitical realities of the world might change, but people tend to do the same stupid things over and over again. And unless we learn from the past and remember it and apply those lessons for the future, we're destined to get stuck in the same rut and repeat the same problems. So the general reason why you want to learn any history, no matter what it is, any topic you're interested in, is there's lessons to be learned there. Now, in Jewish history, we see there's a little added, not a little, it's a big added component, which is what we're going to focus. Really, it's the whole theme of all of what we're going to be doing during this course. And that, by the way, if you look in the second quote from Deuteronomy 32:7, it says, "Zechor yemot ha'olam, remember the days of old, consider the years of many generations. Ask your father and he will recount it to you, the elders and they will tell you." So it's telling us in the text of the Torah, you have to know history. Why? Well, number one reason is the reason I just explained, right? People do the same. We don't want to make the same mistakes. But Judaism introduces an idea into human history which is incredibly revolutionary in all aspects, in the aspect of morality and certainly in the aspect of history. What's the idea we introduce? The idea of a God who acts in history. It's a great revolution. We'll talk about it. The first couple classes, we'll talk a lot about this idea. Fundamental Jewish belief, I'm sure you all figured it out by now. We believe in a God who is the creator, sustainer, and supervisor, which means not a God who created the world and then went to Miami for a few billion years to go on vacation, right? But an infinite being who is actively involved in creation. Everything in the universe is under God's control. Therefore, nothing happens, certainly, in this itsy-bitsy microscopic speck that we exist on called the planet Earth. Everything happening here is under the supervision of an infinite, all-knowing, all-powerful being. Therefore, and this is the big therefore, history is a controlled process leading to a destination. There's a big producer up there in heaven. Which means not only do we want to learn history, to avoid the mistakes we've made in the past, but we have a place to get to. Okay, there's a goal. And that's an incredibly powerful idea in human history. Think about it. That's, by the way, a very empowering idea. Okay, that we're going somewhere. We have a destination. There's a finish line. And therefore, we have to really be careful about not making mistakes because we want to get to that destination as quickly and as painlessly as possible. So therefore, when I'm going to teach history, the main thing I'm going to focus on is not the names, dates, places, although it's very important to know that. I can't emphasize it. It's very good for anyone to have a flow of who we are, just for your identity, where we come from. Jewish history is so interesting, such an amazing thing. But excluding just the flow of the basic events of Jewish history, the main thing to focus on when we learn Jewish history are the lessons, the patterns. So what I'm going to do, even though I'm going to run through all the basic information, the names, dates, places, big events, the thing we always want to remember, even if you don't remember the details, is what is the meaning behind all the happenings of Jewish history. Okay, because this is our guide. So the motto, the theme of the class is Jewish history is Jewish destiny. Okay, everyone should remember that. Jewish history is Jewish destiny. You can't know where you're going to as a Jew unless we understand where we're coming from. Our past is our future. And I think you'll see this very, very clearly. That's why the Torah says, remember the days of old. Because history is the map to get us to our destination. All the secrets, all the patterns, all the strengths, all the weaknesses. What it means to be a Jew. What our strengths are as individuals, as a nation. Our interaction with non-Jews. Our mission in human history. It's all revealed. Especially, by the way, in the earliest books of the Bible. Okay, and that's, we're going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to be, the first couple classes are going to be dealing primarily with the Bible. Okay, we're not going to be looking too much outside the Bible. And by the way, we can't look too much outside the Bible. Interesting point. We're talking about the history of history. There is such a topic, believe it or not. We assume that people throughout human history always studied history. It's not true. As a matter of fact, if you go back a couple thousand years, you'll find people had no interest in history. The first historian in the West, for sure, is a guy by the name of Herodotus. Herodotus wrote in the 5th century. He's a Greek. Okay, he's given the title Father of History. Now, if you look at the last quote here, this is a quote by a historian who teaching at Columbia University at one time. I don't know where he is right now, but his name is Joseph Chaim Yerushalmi. He wrote a book, a very short but excellent book called Zachor, Jewish History and Jewish Memory. And in it he says, if Herodotus was the father of history, the father of meaning in history was the Jews, which is a very profound idea. And by the way, I think we could argue that the Jews actually are the fathers of history. We really were recording history way before Herodotus. But we add a different component into our history. Herodotus might record the events, but we're looking at the deeper meaning. Okay, and that deeper meaning can be found most importantly and most significantly within the Bible itself. When we talk about the history of history, Herodotus is existing in the 5th century. The stories that we're going to look at in the Bible, Abraham, right? That takes place around the 18th century BCE. By the way, is everyone clear on the terms BCE and CE? Okay, we Jews, the whole world now, very important just to keep in mind, the whole world uses a Christian calendar today. By the early 20th century, basically, everyone bought in. That's the first time in human history the whole world has been on the same sort of calendrical system. Throughout history, people use different calendars. Obviously, in 200 BCE, they didn't call the year 200 BCE. Now, we don't use, the term BC means before the year 1, before Christ in the Christian calendar. We don't use that as Jews, so we say before the common era. E-R-A, not E-R-R-O-R. No comment on that. I'm avoiding politics. I don't insult anyone. The other term, after the year 1, the Christian world uses AD, which is Anno Domini, the year of our Lord, who's not our Lord. He's their Lord, so we use CE, common era. So when we talk about 18th century BCE, we're talking about 1700s plus before the common era, like 3,700 years plus, going backwards in time. Everyone clear on this? Once we get to the year 1, we're going backwards. It's like negative numbers on your memory for mathematics. So if Abraham is existing in a period of time called the Middle Bronze Period, and all the periods of this time in history are defined by the major metal, which is the major technological innovation of the period, bronze was the metal of the time. If Abraham is existing in the 18th century BCE, and Herodotus is only writing in the 5th century, what's the problem? He's the father of history. Anyone see the obvious problem there? We have a 1,300-year gap when there are no external sources outside the Bible to describe what's going on, which means that Jewish history for the first many, many centuries exists in a vacuum. Okay, so we have to use the Bible as our source. But then again, and it's very important, by the way, when we're looking at the Bible is not a history book. Okay, no one should make the mistake of thinking the Bible is a history book. It's a terrible history book if you think about it. I mean, Abraham, when he appears in the third Torah portion, Lech Lecha, 75 years old. He's only like the most significant guy in Jewish history. And we don't know anything about like what sports he played, you know, how well he did in algebra. You know, nothing's there. Okay, but by the way, if you think about why we learn history, Jewish history, we realize that God, who we say is the author of the Bible, is a very specific reason why God chooses to pick, jump around and skip. Because God is not concerned with giving us all of the intricate little details of Abraham's life, as interesting as they may be to us. If we say the purpose of studying Jewish history is to learn lessons, then God, the ultimate educator, who doesn't want to fill our brains with a lot of, you know, raw data that we can't process, is only going to focus on the basic information we need to know to get to where we have to go. So although the Bible is not a history book, it's a book of culture, it's a book of theology and Jewish worldview, first and foremost. It's not even a book of Jewish law, by the way. People shouldn't make that mistake either. It's the Jewish worldview. Okay? There's a lot of history in there. Okay, but it's the right kind of history. It's only the basic information we need to know. And by the way, I'm throwing out a lot of little pieces of information here. Whatever is described in the Bible, historically, culturally, whatever, even though it's not a history book, is accurate. We say it's accurate. And there's a lot of interesting, an article just came out in Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, smashing the Bible. The same week, of course, an article came out in U.S. News and World Report cover article supporting the accuracy of the Bible vis-a-vis archaeology. And I don't want to do a whole presentation on the Bible and archaeology. It is a very complicated subject, but it's worth mentioning just for a couple of minutes, because if we're talking about Jewish history and we want to verify events in early Jewish history, the only source we have is archaeology. Does anyone know, by the way, the definition of archaeology? Definition of archaeology. Anyone want to hazard a guess at what it means? Besides sunburn, backache, dirt under your fingernails, that kind of stuff? Understanding culture based on? Very good. Based on artifacts found. Okay, that's pretty close, actually. It's very good. The definition of archaeology is the discovery and interpretation of the physical remains of previous civilizations and peoples. And by virtue of the fact that within the definition of archaeology is the word interpretation, what one archaeologist interprets the meaning of a find can be very different from how another archaeologist interprets the meaning of a find. Archaeology is not a hard science. It's not like math. No one's going to argue 1 plus 1 equals 2. But I find, you know, a piece of rock or a vessel or a piece of a building I excavate, what does it mean unless it's got a label on it, unless it's a written document? And even written documents are open to interpretation. So all I want to say is when people make definitive statements about what archaeology does or doesn't say, you have to be very, very careful. Okay? Because depending upon the bias of the archaeologist, it's going to affect how he interprets the information. So I can give you a lot of information. If people want more on this topic, I don't want to make a whole class out of it, but I'm happy to sit with anyone and give you outside readings. I have all kinds of articles on it. Suffice it to say, in a nutshell, there is very little direct evidence for characters in the Bible. Direct. There is, however, huge amounts of circumstantial evidence, meaning names, places, business contracts, marriage contracts, migratory patterns. There's all kinds of information that's in the Bible that has been borne out by archaeology. When I talk about the Bible, I mean the early books of the Bible. Once we get to like the books of Kings, things like that, we have direct evidence, written records of other emperors and things like that. But the early stuff we're going to be looking at now, it exists more or less in a historical vacuum and unfortunately also in an archaeological vacuum. So the archaeology is more or less neutral on the topic. So if anyone tells you archaeology disproves the Bible, do not believe them. And by the way, the one sentence that you have to remember when dealing with archaeology, which is the last thing I'm going to say about the topic, and it's the same thing for court of law, any future lawyers here? Anyone going to admit they're going to be a future lawyer? Lack of evidence is no evidence of lack. The fact that I haven't found, you know, Abraham's, you know, camel saddle doesn't mean Abraham didn't have a camel with a saddle. Doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Lack of evidence is no evidence of lack. And there is a huge amount of circumstantial evidence supporting the basic historicity of the Bible. So that author, you know, he knows what he's talking about. Okay, again, if you want more information on that topic, I'll be happy to speak about it afterwards to anyone who likes. But again, Bible doesn't definitively prove. It's not there to prove anything. That's not why it's... Archaeology doesn't definitively prove the Bible, and it certainly doesn't discredit it. And by the way, the more we find, the more we see that there's a tremendous amount of historicity to the text. So we understand what the Bible's about, right? It's not a book of history, yet it contains history and culture, which is more or less borne out by archaeology. We understand it's a book of teachings. It's the ideal way to learn history, the basic information. And if we understand that the reason why we're learning history is to learn lessons, then we have to pay extra special attention to what is going on in the Bible. Super, because all of the patterns are laid out early on. I'm going to show you them today and tomorrow. We're going to go through all the basic patterns of Jewish history. Now, there's a very famous quote, which is said by a number of the great Jewish scholars. Nachmanides, the Ramban, says this, amongst others. The basic quote is, Ma'ase avot siman lebanim. The actions of the fathers are assigned to the children. Meaning, on a microcosmic level, everyone know the terms micro-macrocosmic? Microcosmic means we're zooming in. On a microcosmic level, within the Bible, within the stories of Genesis, you're going to see what happens to Abraham is going to be repeated by Isaac. But on a macrocosmic level, the interaction of the personality and interactions of the early forefathers, the patriarchs and matriarchs, is going to be a model for all of Jewish history, all of human history. It's fascinating. You can lay it all out. Okay, Maaseh Avot Siman LeBanim. So we have to pay extra special attention to what's going on at this early phase of the Bible. I'll show you all the patterns. Okay? Okay, so what I'd like to do before we actually get into the history, since we're going to not really get out of the introduction today, is just lay out a couple of basic, as we say in Hebrew, kalim, rules about how to understand history. By the way, people had Dr. Schroeder. You had Dr. Schroeder's classes? Okay, we're not going to... These outlines I gave you here, we're not going to be dealing with, like, you know, the story of creation. Okay, that's prehistory. Jewish history begins with Abraham. Okay, and I want to lay out for you now a map of the, I call it the 6,000 years of Jewish history. So we're going to look at all of Jewish history in a grand way, and then we'll zoom in and go through it piece by piece. And by the way, when you're doing Jewish history, it's very important. One of the great things about learning Jewish history is because we've lived, we're like one of the oldest surviving people on the planet Earth, arguably the oldest. Okay, and because we've had a diaspora that has spread us throughout the world, when you learn Jewish history, you sort of have to study all of human history because we've been everywhere. It's a great framework, just understanding Jewish history to build a whole general knowledge of what's going on in the world at large. Okay, so it's important. And what I'm going to do when I teach is I say zoom in and zoom out. When I say microcosmically, we'll zoom in, look at Jewish history. Macrocosmically, we have to pull out every step of the way and look what's going on in the world at large, because no people's history happens in a vacuum, especially not the Jewish people's. But we say that the Jewish history is especially significant, and I'll explain what I mean later. I'm going to go on a little more and explain exactly what I'm talking about, why it's so important to understand Jewish history, not just to understand where we're going, but to understand where all of human history is going to. So let's now look at our quick little overview of what Jewish history is about. We say Jewish history spans a maximum of 6,000 years. Maximum. Okay? From Adam and Eve till the last possible date when the Messiah can come. Messianic era. So those guys just came in late. I don't have any more of these outlines for you. I'll have to bring some more in tomorrow. You have to look on with someone. Now, without going into Dr. Schroeder's material, and by the way, if you haven't heard him, I highly recommend hearing him. If you don't get a chance to hear him, I highly, highly recommend buying one, if not both of his books, Genesis and the Big Bang, The Science of God. When I say Jewish history begins, or the history we're going to look at begins with Adam, I don't mean from the creation of the universe. Judaism does not teach that time begins the way most people misunderstand it to begin. What year are we in Jewishly? You know? Right, 5760. We say Jewish history begins... Okay, so it goes a maximum of 6,000 years. We're in 5,760. Now, time doesn't begin. This is the big misunderstanding. Again, I'm going to give you this very quickly. Dr. Schroeder, you can get it from him or read his book and get it in detail. The creation of the universe from the Jewish perspective is not 6,000 years ago. That's why we have all these people thinking that Judaism has a problem with dinosaurs and forerunners of human beings. Jewish time begins with the completion of Adam as the final physical, spiritual pinnacle in terms of the creation of the world. The other days prior to that, during those 6 days of creation, until Adam is completed, he starts to be built on Friday, whatever that Friday means, until the soul is breathed into him by God. There's absolutely, not only is there no problem from the Jewish perspective in saying that there are 15 billion years, okay, because those days, you have to understand what those days mean in God time. But not only is there no problem saying that, but Judaism clearly teaches, if you've seen Dr. Schroeder's material, that that's exactly what's going on. Okay, the concept of the universe being extremely old, absolutely no problem. The notion even of evolution, the Bible's discussion of how the world is created, is clearly an evolutionary process from something to nothing, from nothing, right, to something, from energy to matter, to physical matter, to aquatic life, to fish, to birds. By the way, what's the great latest theory on what dinosaurs are most closely related to? Interesting, birds actually, not reptiles. To mammals, to man. It's clearly an evolutionary process going from simple to complex, the most complex thing on the planet Earth, and the universe being a human being. Okay? The only problem, by the way, with evolution is the idea of chance. That the world is evolving, but it's a guided evolution, is a Jewish idea. It's, by the way, an idea that the Jewish people understood metaphysically and scientifically, literally thousands of years before modern science could comprehend the notion of evolution or the notion of cosmology, the creation of the universe, the Big Bang. It's all there in the text. It's unbelievable. it's hard to see. We with modern science, we look back, see how incredibly profound are these supposedly very simple understandings. Again, look at Dr. Schroeder from War. The only problem we have there is chance. Chance is totally antithetical to the Jewish conception of how the universe runs, and it is certainly, by the way, totally antithetical to our notion of history. Nothing's happening by chance, whether it's the evolution of the entire universe or all the affairs of the planet Earth, as insignificant as we may be. It's a guided process. So again, for more information on that, see Dr. Schroeder. But we say that Jewish time begins with the completion of Adam, the spiritual completion of Adam, which is also saying that there's no problem with saying from the Jewish perspective that there were forerunners of human beings, hominids, that physically looked like us, if you know your anthropology, like Cro-Magnon man, right, Neanderthal. Cro-Magnon actually had a larger brain, cranium, I believe, than Homo sapiens sapiens, which is what we are, but actually didn't do too much for a very long period of time. You think of what human beings have done in the last 6,000 years, from simple tools and basic, you know, starting to use metals to, you know, space shuttle and rockets and computers. It's amazing what human beings have done in a very short period of time. Not only is there no problem in Judaism with saying that, but the Torah also it's hinted at. Nachmanides and the Guide to the Perplexed talks about this idea. So that's all that pre-history stuff. We say once Adam is completed, and what's unique about Adam? Adam is a being, what's the tselem? When we say human beings are created with tselem Elohim, what do we have that's godlike? Right, a neshama. A higher spiritual intellectual essence. That's the godlike thing we have, this divine spark. Once Adam is completed, his spiritual completion, his physical evolution followed by this unique spiritual completion, then we say God, so to speak, takes off his cosmic watch, hands it to Adam and says, now we switch to earth time. A day is a revolution of the earth on its axis, and a year is, you know, the earth going around the sun once. That's Jewish chronology. By the way, if you line up secular chronology based on archaeology with what the Torah says is happening, when bronze is smelted, Tuval Kain, etc., you see there's actually a beautiful correlation. Historians, anthropologists basically say civilization begins about 6,000 years ago, 5,500 to 6,000 years ago. When I say civilization, by the way, I have to define our terms. What's civilization characterized by? No, not fire. Not even people living together in primitive agricultural settlement. Civilization is a couple of things. One, if it's people living together in, I would say, cities, when you have a development of culture, language, okay, higher human development. The earliest civilizations we know of go about 5,500 years ago and begin, by the way, in this part of the world, the ancient Near East, which we will also talk about a lot more later. It's saying the development of advanced civilization, writing, which is the single most significant human invention. Okay, well, you know, we don't appreciate it. I'll talk about writing more. It's a really incredible thing, you think about it. Human creativity, spiritual awareness, you know, religion, you name it. It all fits into the chronology laid out. So Jewish time begins with the completion of Adam. That, we say, is 6,000 years of earth time. Before that, 15 billion years, no problem. Now, we say, going back to Adam and Eve, now I'm not going to go, this is not a Bible class, I'm not going to go into all the hours one can spend talking about this topic, but just to give you a bit of information that is vital to understand the flow of not just Jewish history, but human history. From the Jewish perspective, we say the Garden of Eden, okay, we're not talking about the image you get from like medieval art, is a place where you hang out in the buff, you know, like Club Med. It's not the Garden of Eden. The Garden of Eden is synonymous with the ultimate state that a human being could be on. Okay, have you guys taken the five levels of pleasure class sometime? We say human beings are created for pleasure. Now, pleasure is not comfort. Pleasure is not hanging out on the beach with a pina colada. Pleasure is meaning, profound spiritual experience. What's the ultimate pleasure a human being can experience? No, love isn't. Love is up there, but it's not the highest. Relationship with God, right? With the infinite. Basic point of Jewish understanding of the world, which is fundamental to understand human history from the Jewish perspective, and what I'm giving you is obviously human history from the Jewish perspective, is that an infinite creator who needs nothing and can be given nothing, he's infinite, he can't give God anything, creates a world so that he can give. Olam shel chesed yibaneh. Okay. God creates man so he can give, so he can have a relationship. Therefore, the ultimate human experience, the most meaningful, pleasurable thing a human being can do is have a relationship with God. All the love, all the accomplishment that you can do in your lifetime or a thousand lifetimes isn't equal to a nanosecond of being in the presence of the infinite. The Garden of Eden, therefore, is synonymous with the ideal state that human beings are supposed to be in. Close, direct relationship. Okay, and if you look on your little timelines here, we have, going at the beginning, we have starting at Adam and Eve. So let's go lay out our map of 6,000 years of Jewish history. Again, 6,000 beginning with Adam and Eve. and ending with the last possible date when the Messiah comes, which doesn't mean we have to go 6,000 years. It means that's when time runs out, like the clock, Jeopardy, you know, dun, 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 dun. Out of time, Messiah's here, whether you like it or not. Okay? So the first 2,000 years of human history from the Jewish perspective, and we're going to divide up into three sections of 2,000 years. This is our macrocosmic view. The first 2,000 years are called Tohu Uvohu. Anyone know where the term Tohu Uvohu comes from? If you read in the Bible, the first sentence, Bereshit Bara Elokim Et HaShemayim Ve'Et HaAretz. In the beginning, God created heaven and the earth. Ba'aretz Haita Tohu Uvohu. And the earth was void and formless. And that doesn't mean the Tohu Uvohu that the Bible is describing is pre-Adam and Eve. It's the initial instant of creation. The Tohu Uvohu we're talking about here is the first 2,000 years when humanity is spiritually form and voidless. What am I talking about? God creates Adam and Eve to have a direct relationship with them. They blow it. This line you see going down on our little timeline here, it's that we have 10 generations from Adam to the flood. That's not a physical decline. It's not a stock market graph. It's the spiritual divorce of the humanity from God. Okay, we blow it. We get to the point of the flood. God says, I only created a world so I could have a relationship with my creation. My creation is totally ignoring me. Therefore, they've negated the whole reason why they were created. Let's now destroy the world and start again. Okay, that's a very powerful thing. We are only here to have a relationship with God, which doesn't mean we're only here to sit in a cave and meditate, by the way. How a Jew is supposed to have a relationship with God is by acting in the physical world. We're not talking about exotic Eastern religions here. Okay? How you eat, how you go to the bathroom, how you treat your fellow man, how you pray. Everything you do is a way of connecting on some way to this infinite being. We blow it. By the way, this is how Judaism says idolatry creeps into the world. Initially, Adam and Eve had a paganism, right, worshipping a little idols. Human beings found it very difficult to relate to an infinite God. So they started to relate to God's emissaries. Like if a king sends you his nobleman as a representative, you treat the nobleman right, it's going to get back to the king. It's a way of paying respect indirectly to the king. So people would say, you know, I can't relate to this invisible God thing. Look at the sun. That's a pretty powerful thing. I can't even look at it with my eyes open in the daytime. I'll pay respect to the sun, and that way I'll be paying respect to God. Before long, people forgot about God and only paid respect to the sun, and before long, every force in nature had its own little personification of a God that you worshipped, and God is lost. So God says, forget it. We negate the purpose of creation. Let's wipe out humanity and repopulate it. That's the story of the flood. The world is supposed to be repopulated by Noah, and it's supposed to go back up. We're talking about we're up at the top here, right, spiritually. We go down. God is hoping that Noah and his descendants, who are the only people living with the reality of God, will elevate humanity spiritually. Do they do it? No. And the world goes 10 generations down more. Tower of Babel. Okay? And we get to the Tower of Babel as a fascinating story. When humanity is united, but united for the worst possible purpose, which is to rebel against God. And God already said he wouldn't destroy the world. And we seem to be bottomed out there. And then we're going to have one character coming along by the name of Abraham. And Abraham, we say, is going to salvage humanity. Okay, he's going to take the things said about Abraham in the Bible and the rabbinic sources. He's an incredible human being in human history. Such a significant character. Now, for those of you who've seen like this presentation I do called The World Perfect, I talk a lot about the impact of Abraham in terms of ethics and morality. Now, we're going to talk about Abraham off and on for the next class or two. But suffice it to say, for now, we say Abraham comes along, and he's great for two reasons from the Jewish perspective. The greatness of Abraham is that in a world that is entirely polytheistic, he chooses to see the reality of God. He comes to that conclusion using only his mind, which shows you that he's, a very clear-thinking human being. He is not biased by his surroundings, which is a very big challenge. For a person to be able to see through all of the things that society tells us and come to reality is a very powerful idea. It is a great, and the real great strength of Abraham is that, can you imagine being the only person in the world to believe in an idea which is completely incomprehensible, one God, and totally unacceptable to the rest of humanity? None of us would have the chutzpah to whisper to our best friends. The greatness of Abraham is he dedicates himself to bringing that reality to the collective consciousness of all humanity. He says, I choose to live and if necessary to die for the reality of God. Not because God needs us to die for him. You can't do anything for God. But because that is reality, that's meaning. Without that, there's no purpose of being here in the first place. Tremendous person in human history. Have you guys read 1984? I know it's way past 1984, but 1984 was written by George Orwell many, many decades ago. It's a great anti-utopian novel about the world degenerating into this giant police state or a couple of big police states. The main character in the book is named Winston Smith, and he's one of these free-thinking guys. Eventually, he falls victim to the state brainwashing techniques, but he has a line in the book, which is one of the great lines, I think, in literature, which really you can just imagine Abraham saying. He's been captured, and he's being like the thought police have got him. They're trying to brainwash him. And he says, there are truths and there are untruths. And just because you're in a minority of one doesn't make you wrong. It's an incredible statement. That's Abraham. Just because I'm the only person in the world to see reality and everyone in the world tells me I'm crazy, I know I'm right. That's incredible dedication to an ideology. That's what drives the Jewish people. We say when Abraham dedicates himself to the mission, he changes his soul. He gets this added high-test drive. And the rabbis say that that drive is passed on to all Jews. You get it. It comes as part of your Jewish soul. We say Jews have a different soul. Some are better. I'm not having a popularity contest here. Who's better? Who's worse? God judges every human being as individual. But one thing you get as a Jew is this high-test push. Because we're the children of Abraham, whether you're a direct descendant or whether you're the descendants of converts or both. Because when a person converts by demonstrating his commitment to keep Torah, just like Abraham is a convert to an ideology, he's the first proto-Jew, he gets the drive, we get the drive. Comes with the definition of what it means to be a Jew. And by the way, I do a whole presentation called Driven, where I talk about this. You know, it's a hard thing to demonstrate. You can demonstrate physical genetics by looking at the gene. Spiritual genetics of the Jews, that drive, you can clearly demonstrate by looking at Jewish accomplishment in history. A teeny tiny insignificant people who not only shouldn't survive, we shouldn't even be here, we certainly should have changed the world. Not only do we survive despite all the odds, but Jews, despite our teeny tiny numbers, are so impactful in the world it's scary. Take any cause in the world to make a better place in the last 200 years. If a Jew didn't found it, I can promise you, Jews are overwhelmingly involved in it. Okay, incredible. Take doctors, lawyers, Nobel Prizes, it's an amazing, as Mark Twain says in his quote, and you know, we shouldn't even hear from the Jew, but look what he's accomplished with his hands tied behind his back. That's Jewish drive. So this is the great drive that pushes the Jewish people throughout human history. This is characterized by Abraham. Remember talking about, you know, the actions of the fathers are assigned to the children? If you want to understand what the Jew's about, you look at Abraham. Now, when I came to Eshet Torah, like a long time ago, almost 18 years ago, I asked Rabbi Weinberg, what's different about the Jews? And he quoted me two famous quotes from the rabbis. One is, Tzmeim lasot ratzon konam. They're thirsty to do the will of their creator. Jews are driven to meaning. The other quote was also from the Talmud, Maminim b'nei maminim. We're believers, the sons of believers. Rabbi Weinberg told me, he said, a Jew, we inherit the spiritual drive from Abraham. If we're connected to Torah and we realize what our mission is about, we want to make the world a better place by connecting it to God the way Abraham wanted to do it. But if we lose track of that mission, okay, which has unfortunately happened to 90% of the Jewish world today, okay, we're just driven. It's like having a high-test car engine that's running at high gear with no one really driving it, pushing. Okay? So Rabbi Weinberg said, a Jew connected to Torah will try and make the world a better place through the traditional classic way that Jews are supposed to do it. Okay? If not, a Jew is just going to be driven to rise to the top. Whatever a Jew does, he's going to rise. Disproportionate accomplishment in the world that often makes it impossible for the Jews to accomplish. And then he said, when the Jew stops driving himself, he drives his kids. No question, Jewish mother is one of the greatest forces in human history. Okay? So that's very important. We see that already in Abraham. We're going to look at Abraham more later. But I'm just saying this because it shows us that in terms of our historical overview, Abraham, when human beings are bottoming out in terms of their relationship with God, Abraham saves it. Which doesn't mean he instantly elevates humanity back up. But he reinstates the hope in God's mind, so to speak, that humanity can be brought back to reality. Therefore, the rest of, not just Jewish history, and the meaning and message of Jewish history is, it is our mission in history to bring humanity back to God. That's what chosen people is all about. Most misunderstood idea in Judaism, right? Chosen people is not, you know, we're better. We're different for sure. Chosen is Abraham says to God, I choose to live and if necessary to die for the reality of you. And God says to Abraham, you choose me, Abraham? Then I choose you and your descendants, the Jewish people, us. What are we chosen for? A unique responsibility. It's called tikkun olam. Fix the world. What's the ultimate fixing the world needs? To be brought back to the reality of God. To teach by example. to be a living example of a people who lives with the reality of God and teaches the world how to live as human beings. Justice, value of life, morality, love, peace, all those things that are supposed to elevate us, make us godlike, and bring us back to that Garden of Eden. So Abraham takes upon himself that mission. That is the eternal mission of the Jewish people. That is the mission which, although individual Jews can opt out of, God forbid, by intermarrying and disappearing, that is the contractual agreement we have with God. God does not allow us to drop the ball there. Because if he does, humanity returns to negating the whole reason why God created the world. Which, by the way, and I'm just going to say it now vaguely, is the reason for anti-Semitism. It's God's way of waking us up, ultimately, that we have a responsibility we can't escape. We'll talk about that a lot more later. So therefore, the first 2,000 years, we have the decline of humanity, tohu vohu. Decline from high spiritual state to bottoming out to Abraham appearing right on the border there. And then we go into the next 2,000-year period, which goes, if you look on our outlines, it goes to the book of Genesis, to the whole First and Second Temple period. It goes all the way up to about the year 200 of the Common Era. 2,000 years, which we call the period of Torah. That's section number 2, which doesn't mean, by the way, the whole world was learning Torah. But it means that's the period of time characterized by the Jewish people going from a family into a nation, and a nation that will carry on the idea of one God in very difficult circumstances. Okay? That's the beginning of the process of bringing humanity to the realization of one God. Okay? That's period number 2. 2,000-year period Torah, excuse me. The last 2,000 years, which is going to go in our timelines from, it says over here, transition into exile all the way through the Middle Ages, up to our day today, and past till the year 6,000, that is called the period of Messiah. Okay, that's the last 2,000 years of the maximum 6,000-year cycle, which doesn't mean, of course, that we're living with Messiah for the last 2,000 years, but it means that this is the process whereby humanity is being returned to the state that we were in at the beginning. You guys all know Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young? You know the song Woodstock? The refrain is, we got to get ourselves back to the garden. That's what we're talking about here. Getting back to the ideal state that we're in at the beginning, returning. Maximum 6,000 years. Okay, so far, so everything clear? Any questions on this so far? So that is, now the point to focus on here is, therefore, within this whole grand sweep of Jewish history, the major focus of the Jewish people during this entire period of time is bringing the world back to God. Okay, and the major focus, therefore, if we have a unique responsibility in the world, the major focus of all of human history, even though we aren't aware of it, when we look at other events in human history, is more or less bringing humanity back to God. It's not just we do it by ourselves. We have to lead the world back. So all events in human history, not just Jewish history, are going to be leading in that direction, which is, by the way, a pretty wild way of understanding what's going on in the world. It's not the normal way you hear history. It's the ultimate meaningful way to understand history, but it's not the way you'd ever learn history when you're in like public school in 10th grade in New York or something like that. Now, what I want to do, just to finish the last little part of the presentation in terms of introductory information, is to talk about how we view this flow of history. Okay, so if you look time, first of all, the ancients didn't believe time had a beginning. That's something the Jews were always taught. The Big Bang, as George Gamow coined the phrase in 1946, is an idea that the book of Genesis has been talking about for thousands of years. But it's an idea that people couldn't comprehend until modern science finally was able to begin to put, you know, some context to the whole concept. Judaism has taught the idea that time has a beginning, right, has an ending. In the ancient world, the Greeks believed that the world always existed, and that the gods who were outside the physical world, outside the planet Earth, but in the physical world, they were in the world, they weren't outside, not like the Jewish conception of a world, a universe within God, that gods created human beings so that the human beings could serve them. Right, so the gods literally ate. They needed human beings to feed them. They actually ate the offerings. You want to understand why people get this concept of, you know, if I bribe and plead with God enough, he'll change his mind. It comes from a pagan view of what God's all about. The Jewish view of a God being infinite. God doesn't need to eat. You can't give God anything. That's an idea that's very unique. But the basic Greek or classical view of the world in the West was that time always existed, gods created human beings, and human beings were putty in the hands of gods. They played with you, like that little guy in the circle there. The gods are on the outside, and you're trapped. If you read Greek tragedy, the basic message of Greek tragedy is the futility of fighting against your fate. You can't go against fate. If you do, it's going to end in disaster. That's a very pessimistic view of the world. We Jews came along and said, you know what? as human beings with a soul, God gives us free will also, which is a very godlike attribute. And we have an obligation to use that free will. And the decisions that we make not only empower us and affect what's going to happen to us, but affect the whole world. That's an incredible idea, by the way. That is certainly a remarkably positive view of history and the most empowering idea, I believe, in human history. Your decisions make a difference. You have to take responsibility. What you decide to do will affect not just you, but the world. You're not trapped. Okay. What's the Jewish view of time, then? It's not just going around and around. Now, there is an idea of cycles in Jewish history, for sure. You see that little thing I drew on the board there, the going around? That's what I would say is sort of like the patterns in time idea for both the Jewish holiday cycle and the Jewish history cycle. I think I'm going to stop here because this is a good place to break. We did a nice long introduction. Tomorrow, I'm going to pick up with the end of the introduction, and then we're going to start talking about Abraham himself. Okay, thank you. Today, we're going to finish with the introduction and go on to actually starting the history. Holidays in the Jewish calendar are not like holidays in the secular world. 4th of July in America is what? It's a commemoration of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, July 4th, 1776. What's it an opportunity for? It's a day off. You can eat hot dogs, have barbecue, drink beer, of course, drink other things, watch fireworks. There's no real growth opportunity. You can wave the flag and say, God bless America. And believe me, America's a great country. You know, Jewish holidays are often connected to historical events, but they're not commemorations. We say Jewish holidays are opportunities for growth. Every holiday, I'm sure you guys are aware of this, it might be a review, but every holiday has a specific theme. Passover, the theme is freedom. Sukkot, the theme is joy. Now imagine the Jewish holiday cycle is like a giant wheel with sort of like, you know, computer plugs in it. And you're like R2-D2, except you can't move. And you have that little arm that sticks out. You know, R2-D2, he plugs it in the wall and he downloads. That wheel turns around slowly. And each time it finishes a rotation, it gets upgraded with a new version of the program. So like at Passover time again, we get joy. Then Sukkot time, we get joy version 101. The next year, it's 201. Then it's 301. Okay? Each year, there's a different opportunity to grow in your understanding of that concept, to be in a higher level. So yes, the opportunity comes around again each time. But if you're ready for it, you know, you got to have your little computer arm out, be ready to stick it in there. You can't just be, just, if you're not paying attention, it's going to go right by you, you missed it. It'll come around again. You can catch up. But each year, you're repeating it in the sense of the theme, but you can go on a different level. It's not static. You're going forward. So too the Jewish conception of history. Okay? And this is the main reason. This really sums it all up beautifully. The Jewish conception of history, yes, there is a notion of cycles. There's definitely repetition. I mentioned yesterday the famous quote, you know, the actions of the fathers are assigned to the children. Maaseh avot siman lebonim, very famous quote of the rabbis, like the Ramban says this. What happened to the early characters in the biblical narrative in the Bible is going to be the revealed pattern of everything that's going to be in the future. So there's obviously a notion of repetition there, but it's not static. It's not like we're trapped. Have you all seen that movie Groundhog's Day? It's a great movie. I got to get a copy of it to show it before I teach history. The movie's basically a guy is recycled through the same day over and every morning he wakes up, it's the same day. And eventually figures out there's something he's supposed to be doing. Now, I'm not going to give away the plot and ruin it for anyone who hasn't seen it yet. Yeah, honestly, I don't even remember it, so I can't tell you what the point is. If anyone remembers, you can tell me after. But it's a very Jewish idea. We are going to be recycled through the same challenges. Okay, the same strengths and weaknesses that we have in our past are going to be the same strengths and weaknesses in the future. The relationships we have with the Gentiles in the past are going to be the relationships in the future. The trick is, like in the movie, you don't want to have to go through it a billion times till you get it right. The trick is to get it right as quickly as possible so you're moving forward. You don't want to, you know, imagine every day. Memory is an amazing thing. Can you imagine having any memory? Your memory is like 24 hours. Every day there's like, you know, like outside your door, there's like a ledge. And every day you trip over it. And if you had no memory, you'd do it every day of your life. Before long, you'd have like two broken knees and a broken wrist, you know, a fractured skull. This is like the Jewish people in history. We have, if we don't remember, like George Santayana said, those who don't remember the past are destined to repeat it. So the past is our map for the future. We're going to be recycled through, but we're going forward. We're not stuck. We're not stuck. The last little piece of the riddle, and it's the last, we'll end with the most profound question that you can ponder as a Jew and a human being, and then we'll go into history. I'll throw out the two concepts and then see if you can pick the question out. It's a heavy one. It's a big one. We mentioned two things, that the Jewish conception of God is the creator, sustainer, and supervisor. The universe is within God. Because God is outside time, and God doesn't change. There's no time for God. He's outside time and space. God knows what was, is, and will be. Reality is simultaneous. Don't try and think about that too much. You can probably have a nervous breakdown. Now, it's the ultimate profound thought which we cannot comprehend because of nothing in the physical universe that we can tie those ideas into. Infinity. So that's idea number one. Idea number two, I'm telling you, right? Jews teach that the decisions you make a difference. Okay? Our future is in our hands. There's an obvious question. What's the obvious question? Anyone know? What's the most profound theological, philosophical question you can have? All-powerful God, how can human beings have free will? Right? What do you mean? What do you mean we make decisions matter? God, in a book, you guys read a novel ever? A novel is a plot line or a movie. As you're going through it, it seems to have a progression. But the reality is you put the whole book in front of you, and the beginning and the end are all there at once. That's sort of the way God looks at the world. Does the character in the book really have free will? No, he's sort of like the creation of the author. I think it's Breakfast of Champions, where Kurt Vonnegut, he comes down into the book and meets his character. The character like freaks out. It's a very interesting idea. But maybe we just think we're making a difference. We don't have free will. How can God know and control everything outside time and space, yet our decisions make a difference? Yes, it is true that God knows what the end will be. God knows what we will choose, but we are really choosing. Okay? The outcome is known by a being who's outside time. But I know, you can't really comprehend what that idea means. But just to give you an example, and then we're basically done with the background. Imagine you're standing at the edge of a forest, okay? And the forest is long. It's like close to 50 miles across. And you look through a really powerful telescope, and you see all on the other side is a beautiful mountain with a pond, a lake at the top with trees, and it's beautiful, and there's a rainbow, and the sun is shining, and there's a lounge chair and a waiter with a pina colada standing there. And you get like a little tape recording, like Mission Impossible, good evening, Mr. Phelps. Your mission is to make it up the mountain and sit in the lounge chair and enjoy the view. All we're going to tell you is you have a maximum amount of time in which to do it, and we promise you that you will make it. Like, even if need be, we'll come rescue you. You'll make it. Okay? Now, in front of you are like 12 different paths that disappear into the forest. There's one path you can go down where you walk 100 yards into the forest, you get on a golf cart, you go to a heliport, you take a helicopter to a cable car, you go up a gondola. A half hour later, you're sitting at the top of the mountain in the lounge chair, drinking the pina colada, take it in the view. Yeah, that's it. You have the whole rest of the time to enjoy it. There's the other extreme path you go down. You walk 100 yards into the forest, and these little headhunting pygmies start shooting darts at you, and wild animals start chasing you to cut your way through like these thorns or the machete and the rope bridge that's fraying and the volcano and the landslide. And by the way, it's not you're stuck on one path. You can get off one path and go to another path and go back and forth. You can be stupid and go back to the bad path again if you're not too smart. That path, the clock's ticking, dun, 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 dun. You make it, maybe you don't make it. You get to like the bottom of the mountain, you're missing a leg, you get gangrene, your eye's gone, you lost 30 pounds, you have all these like cuts and scrapes on you, your fingernails have been torn out, you're half-boiled by the pygmies. They have to medevac you up the mountain, and you don't spend the rest of the time, in a lounge chair, you spend it like an intensive care unit. Okay? This is what Jewish history is all about, we say. God tells us one thing. The maximum amount of time that I give you to return humanity to the state it's supposed to be in, right, the Garden of Eden, which is synonymous with the Messianic era, is 6,000 years. Remember I said yesterday? 6,000 from Adam till the time when dun, 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 buzzer goes off, scenario over. Now, if God says, if it's going to be that it's going to get down to, 1 second before the gong goes, it's going to be bad news. You're not going to be in great shape. Okay? So the trick is to get there as quickly and painlessly as possible. But it's up to you to decide which path you go down. All you know is that you'll make it. This is where the free will fits in. We have a destiny. We have a destination as a finish line. We're assured we'll make it to the finish line. We have a maximum time frame in which to make it. But how quickly we get there, how painfully or painlessly it takes to get there, it's up to us. Now, what year are we in? Jewish calendar year. 5,760. Okay? How much time do we have left?
40 years.
No, 240 years. By virtue of the fact that we're down to 240 years of our 6,000 years, what does that tell us about the decisions we've made as a people? Jews are terrible map readers. You ever seen that Jackie Mason skit where he talks about, you know, Jews getting directions versus Gentiles? You know, Jews, it's terrible. It's just terrible, you know. Jews at a buffet is amazing. They scout it out. They circle around. You know, when it comes to food, Jews are unbelievable intelligence. When it comes to map reading, forget it. The main reason to study our history, God says to us, you know, he's not just sending us into the forest blind. He says, I give you a map. You just have to be intelligent enough to read it. Jewish history is the map. Jewish history is Jewish destiny. Our past is our future. You can't know where you're going to until you know where we're coming from. We're terrible about learning lessons from our past. If we've waited till this late in our history, you don't have to be, forget the time. All you do is look at the Khmelnytsky massacres, the Holocaust, the Crusades, the expulsion from Spain, the destruction of the First and Second Temples, to realize that we don't learn. So what's the point? Not to throw up our hands and say, ugh, you know, forget it. God rescue me, you know. I hit the bailout button. It can get bad. You know, people say, never again the Holocaust. Things can happen to us and to the world that could be as bad or worse. Believe it. Okay, as Elie Wiesel said about the Holocaust, there's one thing people learn from the Holocaust, you can get away with it. Okay? It's a very heavy idea. Therefore, the reason to learn, the reason, the capital T-H-E reason, to learn Jewish history is not the memorization of names, dates, played. No exams here. Actually, you may have a little one at the end, but don't worry, it's easy. But the reason to learn Jewish history is it's our map to the future. Because every single one of us, fundamental Jewish idea, Bishvili Nivra Olam, every single human being is supposed to say, and especially the Jews, because we have a unique position of responsibility. Every single person is supposed to say, for me the world was created. Which doesn't mean, for me the world was created to abuse. It's, for me the world was created to take responsibility for. And I have to have a guidebook to know how to do that. And we have to learn from our past. We have to now, all of us can make a difference. So when we study Jewish history, we want to focus on the lessons and the meaning so that we can pull out what we need, the information we need to know. And God's a great teacher. He does not fill the Bible, which has, we're going to learn a lot of early Jewish history from, and all the major patterns are there. He doesn't fill it with a lot of extraneous information for the sake of exams and for trivia and, you know, to get on mastermind game shows and things like that. Mm-hmm. He's only going to give us the bare minimum information, which is going to be the guide for the future. So with that in mind, let's now start to go into Jewish history. And again, the early parts of the first couple classes are going to be a lot of Bible stuff. This is not a Bible class, so I don't want to get into the all the different Mefarshim commentaries in the Bible, etc. But I do want to go through the information at a reasonable pace, picking out the patterns and the lessons, because there's no question that the number one area that you want to focus in as a Jew and as you want to be even an amateur Jewish historian is the early works of the Bible. Because this, as you know, King Solomon says, Ein Hadash Tachat HaShemesh, there's nothing new under the sun. Everything is there in the beginning. Okay. So we're going to begin again. We talked about Abraham a little bit yesterday, you know, the proto-Jew, the person who dedicates himself to a mission in a world that's entirely polytheistic. He chooses to see the reality of one God and to dedicate himself, if necessary, at the cost of his own life, to bring that reality to human consciousness. Again, not because God needs us to die for him, but because that's reality. And we said again, just a quick review, that this is the historical mission of the Jewish people. Abraham is, I call him the proto-Jew. If you want to understand what Jews are all about, you got to understand the character of Abraham. I firmly believe, more than anyone else in the Bible, he's the number one guy to study. His drive is our drive. His mission is our mission. Okay, I want to go now to talking a little bit about Abraham, who he is. Now, again, I mentioned the first class that, you know, Jewish history doesn't happen in a vacuum. No human history happens in a vacuum. No people's history happens in a vacuum. We have to zoom out and get a little understanding of where we are in the world. Abraham appears in a period of time called the Middle Bronze Period, around the 18th century, thereabouts BCE. Okay? Now, man, I mentioned yesterday, Middle Bronze Period, early civilization is characterized, and by the way, the Iron Age in the Middle East is a different period of time from the Iron Age in Europe. I mean, whenever they're using those metals, more or less, that's the period of time associated. So I say Middle Bronze Period, that's a period of time which is centered around the 18th century. It ends actually around the 15th century before the Common Era. And he is living in the Middle East, a part of the world we call the Fertile Crescent. I'll just talk about this part of the world before we talk about Abraham. Whereas most anthropologists believe that hominids, human beings, originate in Africa, you know, Lucy, if you're interested in anthropology, human civilization, hominids, by the way, we're talking about people who, forerunners of human beings physically, human civilization, which is something that's about 5,500 years old, okay, begins the earliest civilizations. When I say civilizations, what do I mean by civilization? What characterizes civilization? We have, newspapers, sports, you know, cities, right. We're talking about sophisticated arrangements of people living together, not just simple agrarian settlement even, not just a couple people living in a few huts and they're stationary, right? We have an evolution of humanity from people, from, you know, hunter-gatherers, people spend their whole day looking for food, right, to people who are able to domesticate livestock, which means you can raise animals to eat them, or to use them for whatever, for their milk or their hides or their whatever, and grow and domesticate crops, okay, which leads to, right, an increase in production of food, which means people have time to do other things besides look for food. And then we get to a period of time, which, by the way, corresponds very nicely. We're talking about the chronology from Adam. We're talking about a little less than 6,000 years ago. We say that's when, you know, human time begins from the Jewish perspective. We see that human civilization fits very nicely in that period of time. Once you get to a surplus of food, you can have a growth of population, and people can then start specializing in labor. Okay, and they can do things besides just look for food all day long. They can start being craftsmen, and they can start being scholars and thinking about religion. You have priests and warriors and specialization. Until that time, everyone did everything, you know? Okay, that leads to the growth of cities. The earliest civilizations in the world, according to most opinions. Now, again, we're dealing with archaeology, as I said yesterday. Archaeology is a soft science. It is open to interpretation, like all science. There's no such thing as scientific fact, only theory. Theory means the accepted ideas until someone comes up with better ones. So everything I'm saying now, I have to clarify by saying none of this is, you know, written in stone. But according to virtually all historians, anthropologists, human civilization begins in an area called the Fertile Crescent. What's the Fertile Crescent? Anyone know where it is? Part of it is Mesopotamia. A crescent is a half moon, right? It runs from, on the left is the Nile, okay, in Egypt. In the middle, the Levant, as we call it, is the area of primarily where Israel is. To the right is the E and the T, Euphrates and Tigris rivers. Okay, the three great rivers. Again, to have a city, you have to have a surplus of food. To have a surplus of food, you have to have good farming. To have good farming, you have to have a good water supply. The Nile is an incredible river. I mean, the Nile, without the Nile, Egypt would be a desert. Okay, in ancient times, 3% of Egypt was arable land, 97% was desert. The Nile is the largest river in the world. I think it's also the only river that flows backwards from south to north, I believe. But the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers, which run through what is today basically Iraq and into Turkey, are two tremendous rivers. Now, this whole area of the world is called the Fertile Crescent. To the right, between the Euphrates and the Tigris, that is called Mesopotamia. And you hear the word used, which is the Greek word for the land between the two rivers. All early civilizations. Now, most historians still today hold that human civilization begins somewhere on the bottom of the Euphrates River. Okay? Like Sumer, for instance, is, again, I'm qualifying this a lot because this is under debate now. Sumer is the place still believed by most historians to be the place where the most significant human invention appeared. What's the most significant human invention? It's not sliced white bread?
No.
Sorry, newspaper. You love newspaper. You're right. You're on the right thing there. What's
alphabets.
Writing. Definitely. Now, writing. Okay, now again, there's a debate going on. Some people think Egypt. Writing is not, today we have phonetic alphabets. That's a great invention. We don't appreciate how amazing it is. Writing begins as pictographs. You know that little guy over there? That was the word for man. Later, those pictures will evolve into more abstract signs, which will take upon themselves phonetic sounds. And until eventually, I don't go to the history of writing. It's a very interesting topic. Eventually, we'll get to the situation where you have three symbols, each of which makes a sound, which combines together to make a word which conveys an idea. That's an incredibly profound thing if you think about it. We take it for granted. You have no idea how amazing it is. You know, when the white guys went to America and found those Native Americans used to be called Indians, none of them, almost with no exception, had any writing. It's like magic for them. How could you convey ideas?
So what do they have? Oral traditions, you know, some pictures of buffaloes. Writing is an incredible invention. Because if we sit today with all the technology we have in the world, it's because we sit on the collective accumulation of accurately transmitted information, which now comes so fast you can't keep up with it. But it's an amazing thing. That is the single greatest human invention. By the way, that's the thing we say from the Jewish perspective really personifies what human beings are all about. Speech, you know, writing, conveying of ideas. Okay? That begins, primitive writing begins in places like Sumer and possibly in Egypt. We're not sure. It's a debate amongst historians and anthropologists and archaeologists. But we say this is especially, leave Egypt on the side. Egypt is unusual because without the Nile it would be a desert. And because it was surrounded by a desert, it's virtually unapproachable. Egypt's going to survive for like 3,000 years. An incredible long period of time for civilization to survive. Why does it survive so long? Because no one can invade it. Egypt is basically invaded twice. Once by the Hyksos, and then of course by Alexander the Great, who pretty much finishes Egypt off, and then it becomes a Greek colony. But Mesopotamia on the right is a giant floodplain. First of all, it sits on the land bridge. It's going to connect Asia to the Middle East and Africa, which is going to be the great migration pattern of all ancient civilizations coming out of Asia into Europe. We'll see it in the ancient world. You'll see it with all the Germanic tribes that flood into Europe in the first couple of centuries of the Common Era during the Roman Empire. The history of humanity is, to a large extent, the history of the migration of people. Okay? Because it has no natural defenses, no mountains, no deserts, it's a very fertile place. It's a giant floodplain. It's very weak in natural resources, sort of like Japan is, you know, not much there except very industrious people. But it's a lot of good farming there. It's going to need a lot of trade. Like Japan needs a lot of trade. There's no natural resources, so it's going to attract people. People are going to migrate through. People are going to conquer it. It has no natural defenses. We're going to see a huge number of civilizations in this part of the world. Assyrians, Babylonians, all kinds of Persian empires. Okay? This is where Jewish history begins, at the bottom of the more or less Tigris-Euphrates River, okay, in the cradle of civilization, which is the logical place for civilization to begin in terms of the development of human culture and agriculture, etc. It's also a logical place for Abraham to appear. Because if Abraham is going to be a person, again, from the Jewish perspective, if Abraham lives in Walla Walla, Washington, you know, he's some Eskimo somewhere living at the end of the world. Believe me, there were people already living. Abraham, think of it. Abraham had been born in like South America. You know, people were in the Americas a long time before this history. People migrated across through Asia over the Bering Strait. All of human history would have been different. Abraham appears in what is the center of earliest human civilization, because if he's going to have to affect the world, he's got to be in a cosmopolitan center. If he's in the middle of nowhere, he's not going to have the impact. Okay. Now, we already talked about Abraham, his drive. I want to talk a little bit, to get a little bit into the history now. Again, keep in mind, Abraham is appearing in a place in the Bible, it describes it as Ur Kasdim, Ur of the Chaldees, which is somewhere down in what is today Iraq. If we go back and start looking at the patterns now. Now, if we put this all together, we see. I already said that history is the guidebook for the future. The early lessons of Jewish history are the revealed pattern. So we have to pay extra special attention to anything being said at this period of time. God, again, it's very interesting. We meet Abraham in the Bible, which we just read about a couple weeks ago. He appears in the third Torah portion of the book of Genesis. Okay, Lech Lecha. He's already 75 years old when that story begins. Which is interesting because, you know, we'd love to know what Abraham did as a little kid and what sports he played, etc. But God doesn't want to fill our brains with extraneous information. He only wants to give us the messages we need to learn, because he's trying to teach us. He's guiding us here. Therefore, I have to pay extra special attention. He pares down all the information. He drops out the first 75 years. And by the way, it's interesting. We say that God doesn't even speak to Abraham until he's that age. Abraham is going through pretty much his entire existence as an adult with having no prophecy. We'll talk about prophecy later, which says a lot about Abraham's dedication to his ideology. It's one thing if God speaks to you, right? Assuming you're not hallucinating or taking some drugs, but I mean, assuming you're really a prophet, that'll give you, you know, if God's speaking to you, you'll take any pain to live in that reality. But to just go on the basis of your conviction, it gives us a little indication of what a great human being, what a tremendous idealist Abraham is. So let's now look at the first couple of sentences of the Bible. Again, it's not a Bible class, but to pull out some very sweeping patterns, because really, the three first sentences of Lech Lecha are three of the most basic sentences about all of Jewish history is going to be about. Okay, the number one sentence, the first sentence is, Vayomer Hashem el Abraham, Lech lecha me'artzecha me'molavetecha mi'beit avicha, right? And God says to Abraham, go from your land, from your birthplace, from your father's house. And all the commentators, of course, jump in there and say, you know, God is not like Charles Dickens, the Havdil. Dickens got paid by the word, and he would be as verbose as possible. God is the exact opposite. Why does he repeat it three times? Go, go, go. He's making a very emphatic statement here. Abraham, separate yourself completely, not just from your land. Because you're always sort of, even if you live in Israel for 20, 30 years, you always consider yourself an American or a Canadian or South African, wherever you're from. But separate yourself all the way back to what is your parents' house, your father's house. And another thing I can promise you, I've lived here almost 18 years, unless you were like an Air Force brat and you moved around like 16 times in 16 years and you're growing up, if you grew up in a specific house for a specific period of time, that will always be home for you. When you think of home, you can live somewhere for 50 years, you'll always think of that as home. Your kids will think of where they grew up with you as their house, but you'll never relate to the house you buy and live in quite the same way as the house you grew up in. It's a very deep connection. So God is saying to Abraham, separate yourself on the most basic emotional level. But more importantly, from the more cosmic, macrocosmic historical perspective, God is saying to Abraham, and therefore the Jewish people, Abraham, separate yourself out completely and go in a different direction. It's not just a physical journey. It's a journey through history that is going to be different from anyone else's. Okay? You're not, as it's said very clearly when Bilam the prophet later on in the Bible says, a nation that is not reckoned amongst the rest of the nations. A nation that dwells alone. That's us. That's the unique characteristic, number one, in Jewish history. Number two idea. I'll just read the name of this to you. But it says, I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you, and I'll make your name great, and you will be a blessing. Very interesting idea, number two. God says, the idea of active, God's active participation in Jewish history. I will make you into a great nation. Not just in terms of Jewish impact, but it's very interesting, the idea of God acting in Jewish history. We have a very unusual history. You know, in the 17th century, when Blaise Pascal, the great French Enlightenment philosopher, was asked by Louis XIV, for proof of the supernatural, he answered, the Jewish people, Your Majesty. Why? Because he knew Jewish history and he realized that for the Jewish people to survive to the 17th century violated all the laws of history. Can you imagine what he'd say seeing we made it to the 20th century? It's a supernatural phenomenon. God said, I will be actively involved in your history. I will make you into a great nation. You never should have been. We'll see very early on, Jewish people, we never should have come into existence. From Abraham's wife, Sarah, being barren, that should have been it. That was it. He dies, the mission dies with him. But we survive miraculously. We're born miraculously. We survive all of human history miraculously. We outlive the greatest empires in human history. Unbelievable. So we have different direction, a nation with a different mission, a nation with a different history. Things happen to us. And the big problem being Jewish, by the way, about all the neuroses you get that come with the territory, is the fact that we think for us what is normal for everyone else. We think that living for 2,000 years as a nation without a national homeland is normal. It's not. It's unique in human history. We think that coming back after 2,000 years and reestablishing our homeland is a normal process. It's not. It's unique in human history. And so on and so forth. So it's number two idea. And the last, which is one of my favorites in terms of patterns in human history, is a great one. God says, and I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. Through you, all the nations of the world shall be blessed. Pretty wild idea. What's God saying? People who are good to you will do well. Nations and countries that are good to you will do well. Empires and people that are bad to you will do poorly. And the whole world is going to be changed by the Jewish people. Now, by the way, it's one of the great patterns. You can literally chart the rise and fall of virtually all the civilizations in the Western world where the Jews lived in diaspora. You can chart the rise and fall by how they treat the Jews. It's an incredible idea. Now, part of it is supernatural for sure. Whether it's Spain or Germany or Poland or America or Turkey. I'll show you as we go. I'll just plan all the examples. Part of it, by the way, is not so supernatural. Think about it. If you have a community living within your country of educated, driven, dedicated, loyal, creative, well-connected people, and you're nice to them and you allow them to, you know, participate and contribute in a meaningful way, your country's going to benefit. If you crush those people and expel them, you're going to suffer because that's a simple economic, you know, kind of realization. But there's much more going on than just that. So we have this third idea of the rise and fall of nations and empires is going to be based on how they treat the Jews, which is an amazing idea, amazing idea. And one you can clearly demonstrate in human history. And the last thing is the whole world will be blessed by the Jewish people. And this, for sure, is a pattern you can see. The incredibly positive impact the Jews have had on the world. Forgetting all the great Nobel Prizes and medical achievements and Jews and all these great causes that have made the world a better place. We're talking about the most basic of all, which is my favorite topic, the one I wrote my book on and did the seminar World Perfect on. It's the Jewish people teaching the world how to live together. The values that we get from God. You know, value of life, justice, equality, peace, love. You know. So we see three sentences laying out very basic patterns, right? You have a different destiny, a different history, and a different impact than anyone else in human history. Okay, so we see in that one little area right there, tremendous, tremendous patterns for the future. So not just that Abraham is sort of like the paradigm for who we are in our national drive, but that we're going to see his personal life and the life of his immediate descendants is going to be a mini version, a microcosm of what Jewish history is all about. Let's keep going and look a little bit further on. Now, if you look at your outlines, by the way, we're in the 500 years to the birth of the nation of Israel. We're in phase one. Phase one, which is the development of the family of Israel, which is a period of 290 years. That's going to correspond to the third Torah portion of the book of Genesis, which is Lech Lecha, all the way through to the end of the book of Genesis. The theme of that book is the development of the family of Israel, which means it's the creation of a biological unit. These people are all related, who are going to be the team that is going to carry on the mission of perfecting the world. That's the whole theme of what the book of Genesis is all about. Okay, so that's really, and again, in there, in Genesis and the beginning of Exodus, you're going to have really repeated several times, like over and over again, what all of human history is about. Everything's really packed into there very nicely. So back to Abraham and Sarah. Again, they start out at the bottom, Mesopotamia. They migrate up to Haran, which is in northern Syria, southern Turkey area. That's where God tells Abraham to go to the land of Canaan, which will be Israel. Now, what does God promise Abraham? Besides that, you know, I'll be with you and whatever. He says, I'll give you the land of Israel. That's very important, by the way, because, you know, we say Judaism is God, Torah, and Eretz Israel. You know, God, Torah, Jew, and the land of Israel. Okay? And the land of Israel is not a payoff. Like God says, you support me, it's like some political candidate. I get elected, and I'll give you like a good piece of real estate to build like a shopping mall on. Although God knows Israel hasn't built enough of those. The land of Israel is the laboratory where we are supposed to create the nation that's the model for the world. It's a special place. It's a place that, it's the only place on the planet Earth where the Jewish people can achieve their mission. Because ultimately we're supposed to create a nation that's a model. It cannot be done anywhere else. And we're going to, this is very important to understand our relationship with the land. Okay? And because it's a special place, a spiritually sensitive place, a place of tremendous potential, it's also a place where you have to behave very specially on. We're only given the land because we keep a mission. If we drop the mission, we lose the land. That's a very important lesson in Jewish history, which is repeated, one of the most oft-repeated prophecies. Don't keep Torah, the land will vomit you out. Okay, so we have to understand that's where this whole idea of the land of Israel. And throughout this early part of the Bible, God's going to constantly be talking about giving the Jewish people the land and reaffirming that commitment. Which brings us to an incredibly important, one of the few political statements I will make. I don't usually talk about politics. But if you go back to the very beginning of the Bible, the first sentence, Rashi, the great medieval commentator on the Bible, jumps in, and Rashi is only answering the most obvious questions that a thinking Jew should be asking while reading the text. He says, why does God begin the Torah with the creation of the universe? If the book is a book of theology for the Jews, why not begin with the creation of the Jewish people? Go to Passover story, HaChodesh HaZeh, when Jews leave Egypt. That's when Jewish history really begins. That's when we become a nation, we get the Torah, we go into the land. Okay? And Rashi says, you know why? And he quotes an older source, not his original source, but he says that in the future, the nations of the world will say, Listimatem, the thieves to the Jewish people. You have stolen the land from the Canaanite tribes. So God begins the Bible here at the creation of the universe to tell the world, I am the creator of the universe. Okay? Everything is mine. Ki li kol ha'aretz, right? I choose to give the land of Israel to the Jewish people. Now how's that for a little piece of Rashi prophecy? What is the exact claim made by our cousins, as we say, our B'nai Dodim, our Palestinians, so to speak? you'd stolen the land. It doesn't help, by the way, to be right. We're accused of exactly that, which we're particularly going to be accused of. The point being, the only claim the modern state of Israel can make, that is a moral claim. By the way, what's the claim that all nations in history make to their real estate? I'm stronger than you. It's mine. I took it. I settled it. I've lived here. It's mine. Might makes right is the historic claim of almost all nations in history. Okay, the only moral claim the Jewish people can make is that there is a God, and God is by definition truth, and God is by definition morality. Okay? The creator of the universe gives the Jewish people the land of Israel. Without that, the only claim the modern state of Israel can make is we're bigger, we're stronger, tough. If you don't like it, I punch your nose in. Okay, it's the might make right claim. It's a very important thing, which is why it is so important, even for the secular state of Israel, which is not a religious state, unfortunately, in many respects, but for the secular state of Israel, which is often so far removed from Jewish values, to realize that the Bible, and by the way, believe me, David Ben-Gurion, if he were in this class, first prime minister, not a religious man, boy, would he stand up and give me a standing ovation for that sentence. Because the early founding fathers of the state were deeply steeped in the realization of the biblical heritage of the Jewish people and the connections of the land. We're almost out of time, and I want to stop in a minute. I just want to look at one more thing here, which is Isaac. Now, the story of Abraham and Isaac is very interesting. Sarah is barren. This is a great illustration. God says, I will make you supernatural Jewish people. Sarah's barren. She's so barren, the Midrash says, that she had no uterus. Now, no in vitro is going to help you have a baby with no uterus. She wants Abraham to have some offspring. She takes Hagar, the maidservant. Hagar is the daughter of Pharaoh. Okay, great people have great servants. He marries her, takes her as a second wife. From that relationship is going to become a child by the name of Ishmael. Now, Ishmael is not going to be the one who carries on the mission. Ishmael actually goes off. In the end of it, actually, the Bible says later on he comes back. But he goes off, and he found his own, the lineage is all recorded in the Bible. Now, in human history, we're going to have, after Judaism, we're going to have two great monotheistic faiths that are going to appear later in human history. What are the two great monotheistic faiths that are offshoots of Judaism? No, not Zoroastrianism. Christianity and Islam. Okay, Islam, of course, is a religion which today is founded by which group of people? Right. No, Arabs. Muslims are Islam, but Arab. Now, by the way, there are plenty of Muslims who aren't Arab. What's the largest Muslim country in the world? Indonesia. Okay? So it's not an Arab country. So today, Islam spread. We'll get to Islam. We'll talk about it. But Islam is one of the two offshoot faiths, a religion that believes in one God, one standard of morality. Of course, they have their own variation on the theme. But it's a product of the Arabs. The Arabs, according to their own tradition, are descendants of whom? Ishmael. But what's another great attribute of Arab culture? They're famous for it. They're also hospitality. Abraham's famous for hospitality. It seems that even though Ishmael doesn't carry on the mission, and God says he's not going to be the one to carry on the mission of perfecting the world, he can't but be great. And he's blessed. He says he'll be great. By the way, the Bible also says he's going to be wild. He's going to be peri adam, a wild ass amongst men. And Tim, it's very interesting. You look at the Arab world versus the rest of the world. He has a lot of this, by the way, is the great conflict in the world today since the fall of communism and the Iron Curtain. But if we see number one offshoot religion is going to come biologically from a descendant of Abraham. Very interesting. But then we have this great story we're just in the middle of right now in our weekly Torah readings where the angels come and say, you know, Sarah, she's 90 years old and Abraham's like 99, 100 years old. Says, you're going to have a kid. And she laughs. Not because, you know, Sarah knows God can do whatever he likes. If he could create the entire universe from a spot of nothing, he can make a woman with no uterus give birth at 90 years old. It's a very interesting story what's going on. But this is Isaac being born supernaturally. This is the Jewish people. We never should have been there. We certainly shouldn't have survived, yet we are here. And when Isaac is born, God says, it's through Isaac your name will be called. He is the person who's going to carry on the mission. Okay, I'm going to stop.